In 2009, on the cusp of 40 and a harsh decade of austerity, my mum started to stumble and slur. Despite all her protestations, her GP was sure it was just vertigo. A year later, when I was 17, we moved from Essex to Devon, where we found a better resourced and more trusting health service. A few months into our new life, she came home from the hospital with an MRI scan in a large brown envelope and a diagnosis. I reviewed this lady today, the letter from a neurologist to her GP begins, before adopting an unfamiliar language. The oligoclonal bands are positive in the CSF, and I explained to her that she has the primary progressive form of multiple sclerosis. Naturally, this is distressing for her. Years later, I read a description of the ways in which MS works like a wintering, deep under the skin. The disease had eaten away at the fatty protective coating surrounding her cranial and spinal cord nerves so that the tips of her nerves frayed outwards like the scales of a pine cone. This diagnosis was compounded by the much faster unravelling of our material circumstances. At first, she lost the feeling in her left leg, then her job, then our home. Before you can understand how my mum died, 10 years after that diagnosis, you have to understand how she lived. Sick and poor, she made a workshop of herself. When her hair fell out, she learned about wig making and tracked down cheaper versions of her favourite styles from foreign wholesalers. When her teeth fell out, she learned how to mould dentures from a bright white and pink polymer. She taped her feet to a tricycle so that she could feel the wind in her hair. She made an eye patch from an old bra. Necessity, they say, is the mother of invention. But there's something else in this mix, a defiant kind of self-love, each act a refusal, each invention a gift. These contrivances were a means of survival, in material terms and in more personal, psychological, even spiritual terms. They gave her a sense of vocation, pleasure, creation and repair. More than symptom management, my mum created a pattern for a whole other way of life. World-making against the world, surviving within and against the material conditions of scarcity. In a sun-bleached Polaroid, we sat in her garden, smiling and ethereal. She liked subtle flowers, tiny blue forget-me-nots and wild daisies, both clustered in the photo's bottom left corner. She also took pleasure in the flowers that are particularly hard to pronounce, Gypsophila and chrysanthemum, getting swept up in their delicate airs and graces, accentuating each syllable as if peppering her garden with knowledge. I noticed this in her body words too. A formal medical diction slipped into our everyday conversations. She talked of manual dexterity, spasticity and optic neuritis. She owned these unwieldy words and made them hers, gently applying the proper label to each of her pangs and tremors. This new vocabulary was different to our usual family idiom. Cat soup for ketchup, blancmange for breasts, daffodils or medafs for an anti-fatigue drug. She started and never gave up self-employed work, with her hours and income closely monitored by benefits assessors. Her home was a real cottage industry. She fused tiny glass Mulfuri in a miniature kiln that fit in a microwave. Inside, small beads of coloured glass fused together to create marbled pendants. She painted signs in the style you might find on an old gypsy wagon, bright, broad brushstrokes against a solid black background. She picked and dried the flowers from her garden with great care, setting the petals in resin to make jewellery. In this way, she worked at beauty, making the everyday extraordinary. Beauty is not a luxury, writes Sadia Hartman. Rather, it is a way of creating possibility in the space of enclosure, a radical act of subsistence, an embrace of our terribleness, a transfiguration of the given. Crafting together taught me how to grieve as well as how to live. This fury of making and remaking, this flare and fade.